this week.
Let me be clear. The United Nations is not leaving Sudan.
The United Nations vows to stay in Sudan as the security situation there worsens and people flee the country. UN Chief Antonio Guterres warns the conflict could engulf the entire region and beyond. Has the fighting in Sudan become an international crisis? And what is at stake in the northeast African country? Straight Talk Africa starts now.
The violence must stop. It risks a catastrophic conflagration within Sudan that could engulf the whole region and beyond.
Well, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres there warning that the conflict in Sudan could engulf the entire region. He vows the UN will stay in the country after nearly 2 weeks of deadly fighting between Sudan's army and the paramilitary group Rapid Support Forces. Countries from around the world are evacuating their diplomats, embassy staff and citizens. Other foreigners and Sudanese nationals are scrambling to flee battle zones and the country. Now joining me from New York is VOA's UN correspondent, Margaret Bashir. Margaret, thank you for joining us. Great to see you. Look, as we speak, we are nearing the end of a temporary ceasefire in Sudan. Margaret, from what you're seeing and hearing at the UN, how big of an international crisis is this conflict now?
Well, I think, Haiti, the Secretary General was very clear. He said at a Security Council meeting late on Tuesday that Sudan has seven neighbors and this crisis risks spilling over, drawing the other countries in. We're already seeing people fleeing as refugees to Chad, South Sudan, Ethiopia. The Secretary General said that the power struggle between the two generals is lighting a fuse that could detonate across borders. So his envoy, Volker Perthes, is trying to extend that 72-hour ceasefire that started at midnight on Monday. Perthes briefed the council last night by video from Port Sudan, where the UN has moved a lot of its operations out of the capital. And he said that while things had been quiet in some places, there were still airstrikes and shelling in Khartoum around strategic targets such as the army headquarters, the RSF bases, even the airport. And Darfur also volatile in areas in the south and the west. He expressed concern about some of the tribes there arming themselves and joining the fighting, which he said also could risk drawing in some of the neighbors. So there's definitely this concern about it spilling over. And for other countries, there's this concern for their nationals who they're trying to evacuate.
Absolutely. Margaret, what is the head of the UN mission in Sudan saying, especially about efforts to get the warring sides to the negotiating table?
Right. Well, so Volker Perthes has been there since January 2021, running the UN Transition Assistance Mission, which is supposed to be helping them get back to civilian rule. And he's been in touch with both of the generals. He knows them, so that's good. He already has sort of a relationship with them. The UN's goal here is to get the ceasefire extended, make it something sustainable. That way they can move the parties to talks and then get back to the transition to civilian rule, which was really so close. So that's the end game for them. Meanwhile, they're moving their staff to safety in Port Sudan. They're helping evacuate some of the dependents of them. But the UN is very clear. You heard the Secretary General. They are not leaving Sudan. Already 15 million people were in need before this fighting broke out. So they want to get their aid operations back up and running. But it's been very dangerous and very difficult. Five aid workers have already been killed just since April 15th.
Difficult conditions indeed. Margaret, thank you so much for your reporting. That's VOA's correspondent Margaret Bashir joining us from the United Nations headquarters in New York. Well, now, the fighting in downtown Khartoum and other urban centers has seen people streaming into neighboring countries. According to media reports and the World Health Organization, the fighting has killed at least 459 people, most of them civilians, and over 4,000 people have been wounded. Now, these numbers are, of course, expected to rise, and we're getting reports from the medical aid group Médecins Sans Frontières that it is becoming increasingly harder to treat the injured, especially in and around battle zones. Now, earlier I spoke to MSF's operations director in Kenya, Kate Nolan, and she says Sudan's already battered health system is now at the point of collapse.
So at the moment, supported facilities are continuing to treat patients in Damazine, Blue Nile, in Omdurman, Khartoum State, in Krenik and El Janina in West Darfur, in Rokero and Central Darfur, in Rakuba, in Gadarif States, in East Sudan. We remain committed to providing much needed vital health care to people in Sudan, especially during moments like these. But to do so, we need to be able to ensure the security of our staff and our patients. After over 10 days now of sheltering under heavy fighting, some of our teams have been relocating to a safer location. And there are plans for some others of our teams to leave the country, but MSF is staying in Sudan.
Well, that's Kate Nolan there with the aid group Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders, speaking to me from neighboring Kenya's capital of Nairobi. Well, it's time now for a short break, and when Straight Talk Africa returns, we'll look at the international implications of the conflict in Sudan. My guests are standing by to break it all down for us. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
In times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
Medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Linoch Mudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Welcome back. You're with Straight Talk Africa. Now let's turn our attention to the international implications of the conflict in Sudan. What is at stake and for whom? My guests are Samar Salman. She's a Sudanese analyst. And also with us here is Jeffrey Feltman. He's a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution, senior advisor at the United Nations Foundation, and of course the former U.S. Special Envoy for the Horn of Africa. A warm welcome to both of you. I am so happy you came in to talk to us about this very important issue. Samar, I want to start out with you here. Tell us a little bit about what you're hearing from people inside the country, from family members, from friends. How close do they feel this conflict is coming to a full-blown civil war?
I mean, this conflict is really on the cusp of full-blown civil war. We're really there. You have two state actors. Well, you have one state actor and one non-state actor, technically. Burhan, who is the head of the Sudanese Armed Forces, and General Hemeti, who is the commander of the Rapid Support Forces, the RSF. And it's a hugely violent conflict between the two of them that's threatening to destroy the country and actually tear it apart. So civil war, there are definitions that say that you need a threshold of 1,000 casualties to reach civil war. We're now at nearly 500 documented deaths. So we're really there.
Ambassador, we've seen a temporary ceasefire hold mostly, but at the same time, the UN says it sees no sign of Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, that they're ready to negotiate. Given your expertise and experience in this area, what are you seeing happening here, and what do you think is about to happen here?
Well, I think that the priority being on a ceasefire, being on extending the ceasefire, making a broader compliance with the ceasefire, making the ceasefire sustainable, has to be the priority. It has to be the priority for several reasons. One is simply there are 46 million people who have been taken hostage by these two generals in their lust for power. And those 46 million people need to be able to resupply with food and water and get medical care and get to safety. And so you need a ceasefire, first and foremost, that's sustainable for the Sudanese people. But I also think that you need a ceasefire for other reasons. The longer this fighting goes on, the more tempting it's going to be for the region and the outside actors to start intervening in a way that's far beyond what they've done so far. You've got two generals. This is winner takes all. This is fight to the death between these two generals at this point. And you're going to start seeing countries say, well, you know, I like that general better than that general. And if they're going to fight with each other, we'd better start getting engaged. And that worries me. So far, the region, the international community, outside actors have been united behind a ceasefire. And that's an asset that we have to work with in order to get to a sustainable ceasefire.
That's quite interesting, trying to engage at this point of a battle and gauging which side you want to be on. Samar, take us back a little bit, because this is a question that I have been asking, and you know, coming from a country where the sort of transition to a democratic dispensation was all such an important thing for the country. What went wrong with Sudan's revolution? I mean, what went wrong with this promise of a new dawn, a promise of a new dispensation in the country?
Haiti, that's a really good question, and we ask ourselves that question every single day. Myself, I'm also a Sudanese protester and a Sudanese activist, and so I feel the pain that comes out of this the civil war, as much as any Sudanese. What went wrong? I think that there is unprecedented impunity. There's a lack of accountability in terms of the fact that Generals Burhan and Hemeti have been allowed to get away with war crimes, with atrocities for way too long. If you look at the massacre of the sit-in protesters in June 2019, more than 1,000 killed, bodies thrown into the Nile. I mean, that was a very violent and bloody atrocity. There was a committee that was put together in order to hold people accountable. Up until now, nobody's been held accountable. You have al-Bashir, who was jailed when he was ousted, and he has been wanted by the CCC the ICC for a very long time. I think one of the biggest mistakes we made was the fact that we did not send Bashir to the ICC, because what's happening in this conflict right now, we see two very visible players. We see General Burhan, commander of the Sudanese Armed Forces, and we see General Hemeti, mm-hmm. commander of the RSF. But there's another hidden, mm-hmm. more vicious player, which is the old guard, the deep state, the Islamists, and the National Congress Party of President Omar al-Bashir. They have militias and they have cells that have gone underground. They've now reemerged, and they are fighting on the side of the Sudanese Armed Forces. And there are reports and rumors that the first shots that were fired were actually fired by these Islamist cells, these Islamist militias. So that player is very dangerous, and they're looking to come back into power. There's also a report, still unverified, that former dictator Omar al-Bashir has been released from prison 2 days ago as part of the chaos of the fighting. So he was jailed in Cobra prison. Prisoners have been released from Cobra prison, and he's said to be one of those prisoners that's been released, and we don't know where he is right now.
Ambassador, what's your take on what went wrong in this country? Because the more one hears, the more complicated this seems to get. The past seems to be as complicated as what is going on right now.
Yeah, of course, we're sitting here discussing this with the benefit of hindsight, and so we try to replay what decisions were taken that might have been different, might have produced different results, things like that. So we have to acknowledge that we are arguing with, we are talking with the benefit of hindsight. I mean, the resistance committees on the ground are so inspiring. These were the engines behind the overthrow of Omar Bashir, these resistance committees, and they have been heroic. They have been courageous. They have gone out despite violence, despite being repressed and suppressed at every point. But they are a diverse group, and that's part by design. They come from different socioeconomic backgrounds, different professional backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds, and that's one of their strengths, is they represent a broad spectrum of the Sudanese society. But it's hard to translate that into political power around a negotiating table when you're standing against two generals who were united, and two security services who were united up until April 15th. They were united against any kind of accountability for the crimes, as Hamas said. They were united against any prospect for civilian oversight of the army and the security services. They had a marriage of convenience.
And this is what you write about, Ambassador. In an op-ed you wrote in the Washington Post recently, you said the eruption of violence in Sudan shows the generals can't be trusted. You give some insight into these two warring parties, and you talk about the partnership they once had. And you say what was never decided was which general would end up on top once civilians were permanently sidelined. What made their partnership so wildly successful, and now their rivalry so deadly?
Shared interest against accountability, shared interest against genuine democratic civilian control, shared interest against the civilians being able to take over the parts of the economy that either the army or the RSF was controlling, different parts of the economy. But that, as I said in that op-ed, it was never answered, well, who ultimately is going to be the superior officer. And I really find it dangerous to hear some commentators in the West, not necessarily Sudanese. I trust the Sudanese. You know, they know their country better than any of us will ever know Sudan. To start talking about, well, maybe this general's not as bad as that general. They're both bad. You know, with Burhan, the head of the army, as Hamas said, he's got the Islamists with him. He's got the old Bashir machinery with him. And the Islamists are not just in Sudan. There's a broader financial political network that he can draw on. Hamedi, we know that he's been working with the Wagner group, with the Russians, on smuggling out gold. And if Hamedi ends up on top, you're going to have basically, maybe the Sudanese would be less concerned than I am, but you'd basically have Russian control over the Red Sea from Egypt to Djibouti. Neither of these guys can be trusted. They've proven it time and time again. They've made commitments to the Sudanese people they've broken. They've made commitments to each other they've broken. They've made commitments to the international community that they've broken. But it's a dilemma, because if you get to that sustained ceasefire, which is essential in order to prevent further deterioration in the situation, to allow the civilians some safety and supplies, what do you do? These two generals can't be trusted. The politicians who have been sitting around the negotiating table, people who I worked with when I had the envoy job, I would say they're largely discredited because they don't really represent those heroic, inspiring resistance committees in any meaningful way. And those of us in the international community who thought we could work pragmatically step by step with the generals to facilitate a civilian democratic transition, you know, the Sudanese are pretty annoyed with us as well. So it's going to be pretty hard to put together a negotiating process once you have that first priority, which is a sustained ceasefire.
And that's what I wanted to ask you about the Sudanese. How do the Sudanese feel about international actors? And who really has had a hand in what's going on now, and who has a stake in what's going on now?
I agree 100% with the ambassador. I mean, I think that in terms of, so I think there are two questions here. One question is, who are sort of credible partners that could come to the negotiating table and have some sort of chance of negotiating some sustained ceasefire? I think we have a recent experience with the African Union and with IGAD. Not to say that the international actors haven't been important. They have been absolutely incredibly important. But I think that in 2019, IGAD, Ethiopia, the African Union played a very important role in bringing the different perspectives together. So I think that the international community as a whole is very important. I think the United States has an incredibly critical voice. I think the European Union has a critical voice. Our Gulf neighbors, all of our neighbors are important. I don't think we can have a credibly negotiated ceasefire without the involvement of all of these stakeholders, because you really want to depoliticize the negotiation process. You don't want it to be seen as coming out of one country specific interests or incentives or motivations. So the more parties come to the table, I think the stronger negotiated agreement you can have, and the better chance you can get. In terms of the parties, the actors who have a stake in what's going to happen in Sudan, I think it goes two ways. I think there are countries who have interests, very important interests in what happens in Sudan. I think that there are countries that can be seriously affected by the spillover of the war in Sudan. Right. So let me start with the second one first, because I think the ambassador has really explored the Russian interests that have supported both Al-Burhan and Hemeti. If you look at the surplus of arms currently in Sudan, you have a threat to Chad, which we have reports that Chad has closed their borders. There are militias in Chad, which also threaten the stability of a very fragile country to our west. South Sudan also feels threatened currently by the surplus, this movement of arms and movement of militias. I mean, Salva Kiir has, I think, his own issues in South Sudan right now in terms of maintaining peace and maintaining stability there. I think that Ethiopia to the east has just come out of a war and needs to sustain their peace. So I think that in terms of players that have interests in Sudan right now, I think you have Egypt to the north, I think, has shown that it supports General Hemeti, and there are reports that he's made an offer to supply Hemeti with arms. In terms of Burhan with arms. General Haftar of Libya has also stated publicly that he'll support Hemeti with arms. So you have a lot of varied players that are threatening our ability to bring peace to Sudan.
And Ambassador, I know you want to comment on this, and I'll give you a moment. I just want to play a clip for you very quickly. And this is about, you know, the what we talked about earlier about the actors, of course. This is by Jacqueline Byrne. She's a former advisor to the U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan and South Sudan. Listen to what she told my colleague Salem Solomon.
First of all, I would clarify that it's not just the United States. There were a lot of international actors, including the United Nations, the African Union, the European Union, and other nation states who were involved in these peace processes over the last two decades in Sudan. But overarching, the idea is that we spent decades, as I said, in these peace processes, facilitating these peace processes with the armed actors, trying to get them to agree to some types of concessions, to for power sharing arrangements, to end the conflicts in Sudan. But unfortunately, in doing this, we allowed these processes to be very exclusionary, to include primarily only the armed actors, who we had every indication were not actually interested in peace or in political reforms, but rather only in shoring up their own political power bases in the country. And by doing this, and by keeping other groups, other actors for peace excluded from the processes, we gave legitimacy to these armed actors, both inside Sudan and outside of Sudan. And we led them to believe that their demands, that their goals would continue to be prioritized. So it was a system of legitimizing and emboldening these leaders that have led us to this point. And I would say that the dynamics were ongoing since 2005 after the Comprehensive Peace Agreement, but they got worse since 2019 when the international community de facto started treating Hemeti and Al-Burhan, the two military leaders that are fighting now, as the political leaders of the country, when they in fact were military leaders who had taken control violently from the civilian-led government.
I want to hear your take and, of course, what you wanted to add to what Samar said.
I think Samar's analysis was spot on. And of course, we all have to be studying, and I'm sure there will be many people who will be studying this trajectory since 2005, 2009 and onward to draw lessons from it. But where we are right now is that there are 46 million people who have been taken hostage in a power struggle between these two generals. And what do we do? Let's draw on the lessons, on try to learn from the mistakes we had before. But as Samad was saying, there is one asset here I believe that we all have, which is that nobody wants to see Sudan destabilized. Maybe General Burhan or Hemeti are willing to take it into destabilization, but certainly the Sudanese civilians don't want to see Sudan destabilized. Sudan's neighbors, whatever they may think of this or that general, don't want to see Sudan destabilized. The Saudis, the Gulf Arabs, do not want to see their investments, their potential investments in Sudan threatened, or refugee flows across the Red Sea. And the international community doesn't want to see Sudan destabilized. So how can we take that unity, that agreement, and turn it into and put it behind some kind of political process? We may, and I think that what we have to do, the argument we have to make, is that a Sudan that's ruled by Burhan is not going to be stable. A Sudan that's ruled by Hemeti is not going to be stable. A Sudan that has some kind of political process in which the two generals have some kind of power sharing agreement that we all have blessed as a temporary measure, that's not going to be stable, as we've seen both in 2021 with the coup and today. So what would be stable? If we can convince all of the neighbors that want to, and the regional partners and the international community that want to see a stable Sudan, that it has to be a different type of process that's happened so far, I think that we then can get behind an African initiative, an IGAD initiative, that would look different. Even if there's a total ceasefire today, we cannot go back to the type of discussions that were taking place as late as early April. There's just no credibility in that process at this point.
Samar, we've got about a minute and a half here. Can any Sudan that is peaceful, that is stable, that is prosperous exist with these two men as part of the country's future?
I believe that two men who have come to blows and led to the complete and full destruction of Sudan have no role in a peaceful and democratic Sudan. I just don't think that's possible. I don't think so, no.
Well, we will certainly be keeping our eye on, and please, I would love to have you both back on the show here. Hopefully we can come to a point where this is resolved, where we can at least see peace happen. But in the meantime, we will come back to you again for some more of your insights. Thank you so much, Jeffrey Feltman.
Thank you for having
and
me.
Samar Salman.
Thank you very much
for your time and for your insights. And that is our show this week. We'll leave it right there. Check out our Facebook page and let us know what you think about the conflict in Sudan. We do thank you for joining us every week. Thank you for always watching and for always listening. And I'll see you next time. Goodbye.